Good afternoon and welcome to the joint meeting of the Growth Management Oversight Commission, Planning Commission, and majority of the Chula Vista City Council. Please stand and face the city flag, knowing that the U.S. flag is just beyond it at City Hall, and remain standing for a moment of silence. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
First, thank you very much. We anticipate tonight's hearing to be no more than 2 hours, but if we need more than 2 hours, we'll stop, take a break, and charge ahead. It's a pleasure to welcome you here today. We've got representatives from the City Council, Growth Management Oversight, and Planning Commission. I'd like to acknowledge City Manager Jim Sandoval, who is going to introduce some of the members of his staff. When the staff begins their presentation, I just ask you to keep notes of any questions or comments you have so we can go through the presentation. And then with the council's consent, we'll go through the items that are compliant first, thinking that will get us pretty much through the majority of the agenda, and then take a little more time on the non-compliant. So, Madam Clerk, would you like to have the roll called for the boards and commissions? Ask the chair of the Planning Commission, that is Mr. Spethman, would you call your roll?
I'm vice chair, but I'm member Commissioner Montezuma has
so we have everybody here, Mr. Anaya, Ms. Calvo, Mr. Spethman, Mr. Vinson, Mr. Leewag, and Ms. Torres. Oh, no, you're with GMLC. I got to put a firewall between the two of you. And Lisa Moctezuma is absent. And the chair of GMLC, Armida, would you call the roll for your commission and note who is not here? And with that, I'll turn this over to City Manager Sandoval. If you do have a cell phone, please make sure that it is well away from the microphones. And if you've got an opportunity to turn it off completely, we won't be affected by that buzzing throughout our meeting. Mr. Sandoval.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. And I want to echo your thoughts and thanks to all that participate. You know, I think we're over 25 years now with growth management, and it's something that's really helped the city and guide us as we've done development to make sure that our infrastructure and our ability to provide services keeps pace with development. And it's a program that has helped our city, but it's actually been looked at in the years I was in planning and even since then as really a model for the nation on how you do growth management. So it's a very worthwhile program. I want to recognize, since he's here, Dwayne Basil, who guided this program, helped create it years ago. And then also thank Kim Vanderbee and Ed Batchelder, who today have that job of making sure that we give our committees and our commissions and the GMLC the tools they need to get the job done. I believe, Ed, you're going to start it off.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Jim, Madam Mayor, City Council members. I'd like to offer my thanks to the Growth Management Commission in particular. Dealing with 11 different subject matters is unique for a city board and commission. They put in a lot of time across a diverse range of subjects. And we had a few commissioners who joined us late in the process this year, but nonetheless jumped right in. So over those many years, Jim, I've seen a great complexion of different growth management commissions, and always a good, robust discussion. I think it's evidenced in the report. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kim, who's going to coordinate giving the presentation along with the GMLC chair. Thanks, Kim.
Good evening, Madam Mayor, City Council, Planning Commission, and GMOC. We're here this evening to review the 2013 Growth Management Oversight Commission annual report, which covers the period from July 1st, 2011 through June 30th, 2012, and identifies current issues in the second half of 2012 and early 2013. It culminates the work of the GMOC, who met 9 times since last October. And during that time, the commissioners volunteered several hours of their time to prepare the report before you this evening. Before going over the report, I'd like to recognize the GMOC commissioners and look at the annual review process. The GMOC members are Armita Torres, Chair, who represents business, Carl Harry, Vice Chair, Development, David Donsu, Southwest, Eric Masolgo, Environmental, Javier Rosales, Southeast Bonita, Leslie Bunker, Education, Mark Lewag, Planning Commission, Russ Hall, Center City, and Zanita Encarnacion, Southeast. The GMOC implements the city's growth management plan program and prepares the annual threshold compliance report. The GMOC's role is to implement the city's growth management program, which was designed to preserve and enhance the public services and quality of life enjoyed by Chula Vista residents as growth occurs, and to prepare annual threshold compliance reports. The growth forecast begins in July through October. The meetings begin in October. We try to wrap up by March and bring the annual report to you by April. At this point, I'd like to introduce Armita Torres, who is the chair of the GMOC. She will be going over all the threshold standards, indicating which ones were compliant, which ones were non-compliant, and after her presentation, we'll make a recommendation and the mayor will open the public hearing. Thank you.
Good evening. Madam Mayor, City Council, Planning Commission, fellow GMOC commissioners, I am pleased to present a review of the 2013 annual report. Threshold standards for 11 quality of life indicators were reviewed. 4 were found to be non-compliant, 7 were found to be compliant, and the 4 thresholds found non-compliant also have the potential to remain non-compliant in the future. The 4 non-compliant threshold standards are libraries, police, both priorities 1 and 2, traffic, and fire and emergency medical services. I will review each of these individual threshold standards, beginning with libraries. The threshold standard for libraries is 500 gross square feet per 1,000 population. For the 9th consecutive year, libraries is non-compliant with the threshold standard due to inadequate PFDIP funds to construct additional square footage. Therefore, once again, the GMOC stresses the importance of council adopting an updated libraries facilities master plan that identifies interim and long-term solutions to the current square foot. Current square footage deficit. GMOC recommends that City Council, without further delay, adopt a libraries facilities master plan that provides interim and long-term solutions to bring the library system into conformance.
And the staff response is, per council request, a strategic visioning component is being added to the draft library facilities master plan, and negotiations are currently underway to finalize the contract. We expect to bring the documents to City Council this fall.
The police threshold, priority 1, emergency response requires that units respond to 81% of priority 1 calls throughout the city within 7 minutes, with an overall average response time of 5.5 minutes. Priority 2, urgent response, requires units to respond to 57% of the priority 2 calls through the city within 7 minutes, with an overall average response time of 7.5 minutes. Threshold findings for both priority 1 and priority 2 were non-compliant. Here's a real quick explanation of priority 1 emergency calls. These calls indicate an immediate response by 2 officers from any source or assignment. These include life-threatening calls, felony in progress, crimes or accidents with a probability of injury, robbery, and panic alarms and urgency cover calls from officers. Priority 2 calls indicate an immediate response by 2 officers from clear units. They include misdemeanors in progress, crimes, or accidents with the possibility of injury, and serious non-routine calls, domestic violence, or other disturbances with potential for violence. For the first time since 2004, the Priority 1 threshold is non-compliant. Calls responded to within 7 minutes dropped by more than 6%. The police department attributed this shortfall to low staffing in the Community Patrol Division. The Priority 2 threshold standard was also, for the 15th year in a row, non-compliant. The police department cited low staffing for this deficiency as well. However, part of the problem, as noted in previous GMOC annual reports, is that the current Priority 2 threshold standard has some flaws and will be modified through the top-to-bottom process. Overall, the GMOC is concerned that the trend for both Priority 1 and Priority 2 calls is headed in the wrong direction, and we will continue to monitor these closely in future reports. GMOC recommends that City Council support the police chief's efforts to increase staff to budget levels and to effectively manage the work schedules to improve response time.
And the staff response is, the police department is actively recruiting both entry-level and lateral peace officers in order to be able to come up to full staffing levels in the sworn ranks. The department has also temporarily reassigned the street team to patrol to enhance staffing levels while the department continues to recruit officers. The department will also be seeking council approval on a new false alarm ordinance, which will seek to reduce the number of false alarms by upwards of 75%. If the new ordinance is successful, this endeavor will help improve response times.
Traffic threshold is to maintain a level of service C or better as measured on all signalized arterial segments, except that during peak hours, a level of service D can occur for no more than 2 hours a day. During the period under review, the threshold was non-compliant, broken down into four separate issues. The first one, this year, two signalized arterial segments were found to be non-compliant, as indicated on the slide. GMOC recommends that City Council continue to support city engineers in their efforts to implement improvements that will result in threshold compliance.
And the staff response is, the Public Works Department concurs with the recommendation. Recommendation is accepted. One technician position is currently budgeted at half full-time employee, increasing to one full-time employee in current fiscal year, would restore traffic engineering to previous TMP staffing levels in time for the 2014 GMOC TMP program. And two, Otay Lakes Road widening project has been awarded and contractor will be starting work within 30 days. Olympic Parkway left turn pocket is currently in design with construction scheduled for later this calendar year.
Issue number two. While SR 125 has seen a 30% increase in ridership in the 16 months of Sandag ownership, it is still underutilized. Our recommendation is that City Council and staff work with Sandag on incentives for Chula Vista residents to use State Route 125 more frequently.
And the staff response is, the Public Works Department concurs with the recommendation. Recommendation is accepted.
Issue number three. GMOC has serious concerns surrounding the chronic non-compliance of the traffic threshold standard and the delay in continuing Heritage Road to Main Street. Recommendation is that City Council support city engineers in their efforts to construct Heritage Road and work to ensure construction of the connector from Main Street to State Route 905 and the Heritage Road southerly extension to Main Street.
And the staff response is, the Public Works Department concurs with the recommendation. Recommendation is accepted. City staff has reached an agreement with developer to secure and commence construction of Heritage Road from Olympic Parkway South as first phase. Future phase to extend to Main Street will be expedited. City staff will continue to work with Sandag and City of San Diego for needed improvements in the East Otay Mesa area, including but not limited to SR 905.
Traffic issue number four. Funding is needed to complete the Palomar Street light rail trolley crossing. Recommendation is that City Council and staff work with Sandag on securing complete funding for the Palomar Street light rail trolley grade separation.
And the staff response is the Public Works Department concurs with the recommendation. Recommendation is accepted. Funded environmental document work will begin later this fiscal year. Staff will pursue funding for design and construction.
We have one last comment regarding traffic. While it is within GMOC's purview to request a hearing to consider a moratorium on tentative maps or building permits, we're choosing a different course of action. We're asking that the city conduct a public workshop to discuss the traffic issues as they stand today, as well as forecasted conditions and roadway improvement plans. This workshop would be highly informative and beneficial to the public in understanding the planning and expansion of the circulation system and ongoing threshold compliance conditions. We'd like to ask that this workshop be held in the fall in compliance with the beginning of our 2014 annual report. Fire and emergency medical service. The threshold standard of properly equipped and staffed fire and medical units responding to calls throughout the city within 7 minutes in 80% of the cases was found to be non-compliant. For the second consecutive year, response times have fallen below the threshold standard. GMOC recommends that City Council direct the fire department to implement effective measures that will ensure that the standard will be met.
Staff response is that the fire department recently purchased a 911 dashboard program called First Watch that will alert senior staff and battalion chiefs anytime one of the citywide or GMOC threshold standards are not being met. This will allow staff to take immediate action to address and resolve any issues related to these parameters.
The second issue in fire is that the delay of a council-approved fire facilities master plan update will hinder the finance department's efforts to complete a comprehensive PFDIF update, which was last completed in 2006. GMOC recommends that City Council ensure expeditious completion of the public information meeting and scheduling for council consideration so the updated fire facilities master plan can be included in the next PFDIF update.
And the staff response is that the meetings for public outreach are being scheduled and will take place by the end of July. The fire facilities master plan will then be presented to council with a recommendation for adoption.
The compliance threshold standards are parks and recreation, fiscal, drainage, schools, sewer, air quality, and water. Although these seven were all found to be compliant, we identified issues within parks and recreation, fiscal, and drainage, and I will briefly review, which I will briefly review individually. Parks and Recreation. The threshold standard is 3 acres of neighborhood and community parkland with appropriate facilities per 1,000 residents, east of I-805. While found to be compliant with the threshold standard, three issues were identified. The first is, Parks and Recreation Department noted in their responses to GMOC's 2012 questionnaire that there is a potential non-compliance with the threshold standard by the end of the year. GMOC recommends that City Council direct Parks and Recreation staff to closely monitor parkland development phasing to keep it in compliance with the threshold standard.
And the staff response is, staff will schedule the preparation of individual park master plans with the objective of keeping in compliance with GMOC park thresholds to the extent that it is possible within the fluctuating timelines and physical constraints inherent in development.
Issue number two, a draft Parks and Recreation Facilities Master Plan has been delayed once again. GMOC recommends that City Council support staff in their efforts to resolve issues that may affect expeditious scheduling of the citywide Parks and Recreation Facilities Master Plan for council consideration by the end of the calendar year.
Staff response is the citywide Parks and Recreation Master Plan will be submitted for council action upon resolution of the incorporation of landmark park implementation policies into the document by the end of 2013.
Issue number three, the city needs to maximize opportunities to generate revenue and to expand services. The recommendation is that city review opportunities for potential capital improvements, which will provide new services and recreation to the community while generating revenue. Some of the suggestions were to replace a small portion of grass areas with batting cages or skate parks in new park development. This would not only reduce ongoing maintenance costs, but would also generate revenue.
And the staff response is, staff will consider the revenue-generating aspects of facilities during the master planning stages of individual park master plans in conjunction with the program elements listed in the citywide Parks and Recreation Master Plan.
Fiscal threshold standard requires that GMOC be provided with an annual fiscal impact report and with a development impact report. The issue in fiscal is, although fiscal was found to be compliant, the GMOC is concerned with the city's lack of a debt service payment policy. GMOC recommends that City Council direct the Finance Department to continue the process of comprehensively updating the public facilities development improvement fees so that it will be completed within 120 days of Council's action on proposed unit increases, and that Council adopt a debt service payment policy as soon as possible.
Staff response is that Finance Department staff supports the GMOC's recommendation to continue the process of comprehensively updating the public facilities development impact fee. In addition to Council action on proposed unit increases, Council action to adopt the pending library, fire, and park and recreation master plans is also necessary. Staff recommends that any Council direction reflect these additional required steps in advance of the comprehensive PIFDIF update. Staff is in the process of drafting a debt service policy. The draft policy will be presented to Council for consideration in calendar year 2013.
Drainage, the threshold standard. We have two. One is, stormwater flows and volumes shall not exceed city standards. And two, the GMOC shall annually review the performance of the city's storm drain system. The 2013 annual report indicates that, once again, adequate funding for channel maintenance is an ongoing problem. And GMOC has two recommendations. The first is, GMOC recommends that City Council direct engineering staff to closely monitor the status of channel maintenance to keep it in compliance with the threshold standard.
Staff response is, the Public Works Department concurs with the recommendation. Recommendation is accepted.
The second recommendation is that City Council identify funding to implement state-mandated storm water flow regulations designed to avoid potential flooding and or health issues.
Staff response is, the Public Works Department concurs with the recommendation, and the recommendation is accepted.
Schools threshold standards. The two school districts, Chula Vista Elementary School District and Sweetwater Union High School District, are asked to identify if they can accommodate forecasted and continuing growth. Both school districts were found to be compliant. Sewer. Sewage flows and volumes shall not exceed city standards, and the city annually provides San Diego Metropolitan Sewer Authority with a development forecast to project appropriate capacity rights. The sewer threshold is found to be compliant. Air quality threshold standards. GMOC is provided with an annual report which identifies any air quality issues which may be of concern and was found to be compliant. Water. Water districts provide the appropriate data to ensure they can provide water to meet the needs of future development. GMOC reviews questionnaires from both Otay Water District and the Sweetwater Authority, and both were found to be compliant. This concludes the 2013 GMOC Annual Report. At this time, I invite my fellow commissioners to provide any additional comments. Thank you.
If you're a GMOC commissioner and you want to add a comment before the public hearing is open, please capture the attention of Ms. Torres and she will call upon you. You have one microphone to share. So, Leslie, I'm going to ask you to pass that microphone down to Mr. Donahue. Because we don't have televised hearings, please arm me to keep calling people by name, because then the clerk will be able to pick it up. Thank
Commissioner
you.
Commissioner Danfield?
I think we can probably get into this more in a public hearing, but I just wanted to bring it out that there, as far as traffic is concerned, on Olympic Parkway. We did have a threshold of LOS of F at the 805 interchange, westbound in the morning, and it technically didn't make this report because it calls for a two-hour window of a traffic situation, but that is something that we really need to work on and rectify.
Are there any other comments? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Torres, for your report. I'm going to open the public hearing. I have no comments from the public to be heard. I'm going to confirm with the city clerk. None? I'll close the public hearing. This is a sissy gavel. You know, the day I leave office is when I'm going to get a real 3-foot gavel. What we're going to do at this point is, for those of you who are following either on your iPads or following on a printed version, is to begin with parks. Parks begins on page 1-33 for those who are looking for the page numbers that are typically handwritten. I'm going to give Kim a chance. Oh, look at you, right there already. I'm going to ask you if you would go to the GMOC recommendation. Give people a chance to refresh it, then toggle to the staff recommendation, and then back again. So that'll be sort of our this way, that way. I'm going to start with Ms. Calvo. Do any of you members question or comment regarding parks?
No. Commissioner Stefman?
I don't know. Is there a representative from Parks and Rec? I mean, we've combined parks.
Tom Adler is here and
okay.
Christy McClure is here.
Okay. I had a couple questions regarding the master plan.
Mr. Spethman, hang on for just a sec. Mr. Adler, Ms. McClure, would you make your way up to the microphone, and then you can tag team this answer. Thank you, Mr. Spethman.
Sure. You know, the master plan for Parks and Rec, I did 5 years on GMOC, and we're still trying to get a master plan. And I've been on the Planning Commission for 7 years. And every year that I come for this presentation, we're still waiting for the master plan for Parks and Rec. My question to you guys is, you know, and be as honest as you can, I expect you to. Does this have anything to do with the consolidation of Parks and Rec and the libraries? Are you understaffed?
In regards to the collaboration of the library and recreation departments, it really has to do with Public Works and Recreation Department working together. And I believe it was identified in here as the landmark park is really the issue of completing the Parks and Recreation Master Plan. And that's what staff is currently working on right now as far as identifying the needs of Landmark Park and what's associated with it.
You're referencing a landmark park on the western side of the city? When you say Landmark Park, are we talking west or east?
When I say Landmark Park, I'm referring to the formerly known as the 70-acre park. But there's a few park issues in play, and we're still trying to nail down where exactly that landmark park is.
So it's not specific that it's going to be the landmark park is going to be on the east or the west?
Right now, there's still a few issues in play. One of them is a three-way deal with developers to try to sort out what that 70-acre park is going to be like. And there's a number of agreements running through city council, through the city staff right now, too. Understand what that park needs to be at the end of the day, but we're still not quite there yet. We're still processing the land plan.
I think, Mr. Adler, are you referring to the fact that some of these are land exchange agreements and you aren't going to know where that 70-acre is until those land exchange agreements are completed?
Exactly. They're tied up with the SPA plans.
Okay. I think the city manager might have an additional comment.
Just a little bit more clarification. Mr. Adler is correct. What it is let's hold it up, is we have in planning right now for a 70-acre park in eastern Chula Vista. What we're looking at is an opportunity to maybe maximize and get more, actually more park land than that by working at a trade agreement with some of the developers that would assist with circulation. We think give us a better park site and shrink that 70 acres there to something smaller, maybe 40 acres, and then potentially pick up to 100 acres that could be used for active sports, tournaments, that kind of thing. And we're evaluating that and working with developers, and that's really, as you can see, what you see a huge aspect of where this park's master plan goes. That's what's holding it up, but we're much closer. So I understand your frustration, but we're pretty close to having that situation taken care of.
Okay. And my final question, what is your staff level that is dedicated specifically to Parks and Rec?
I think that's the number one question since I've been here. Parks and Recreation are two separate departments. So Recreation Department oversees the programming aspect, and I could speak to that as the assistant director. We have currently 17 full-time staff, but they're out at the park sites, specifically the park sites that have complexes such as Salt Creek, Veterans, Heritage, and Montevallé. But as far as the parks aspect, it's actually in the Public Works Department. However, our departments work very closely together. We have coordination meetings, and we have a number of staff that are actually dedicated to this Parks and Facilities Master Plan and working behind the scenes on closing more of the operation between the landmark park. So myself, since I've been here for 6 months, have probably been in about 5 to 6 meetings about this, trying to work on this so we can come to you with a full plan.
I guess more specifically, what is your management and supervisory staff as it relates to Park and Recs?
So, again, I'm thinking back to the days of Jerry Fonserrata, where we had a Parks and Rec department, and that's gone the way of the buffalo. So
we had one last year.
Right. Let me speak to that. The department last year was recreation. However, there's a lot of crossover between what Parks and Recreation does. We work together, but Parks and Recreation, the programming aspect is in the Recreation Department. The maintenance and operation and capital improvements belongs in the Public Works Parks Department division. So we still, no matter what, we're a city. We work together. Even though we have names as a department, we still work as Parks and Recreation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if you want to recognize any other members of your commission on the topic of parks.
Anybody else have any comments?
Yeah.
Oh, Commissioner Lewis.
This is, it's with parks, but it's with all the master plans. And it seems like we haven't been able to get the master plans completed, which holds up the fifth disc. And it seems like we're keeping working on details of the construction of the plans, little details that aren't really needed for finance to do. If we can adopt some of these plans, even if some of those things are still somewhat open-ended, but at least constrain what the dollar amounts would be out of those plans and those phasings of those dollars, then we can at least move on with the PIFDIF. And we haven't been able to get any of the plans done in the last couple of years because we keep working on some other details of that, but may not be financial. And if we can at least get some of those plans completed, at least from a financial standpoint, at least some of those other things open, they can always be updated. But I think we keep looking for a perfect plan with every detail done before we adopt it, and then we delay the financial aspect of it.
I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Sandoval to give you a little more complete answer. But one of the reasons that staff has not been able to progress on the plans as quickly as they'd like to do is the seesawing economy. It's been just a consistent down. So they're putting their priorities towards getting the jobs done today, and having that financial certainty will make a better plan. But I'm going to let Mr. Sandoval respond to you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Mayor. I guess I would say I understand your concern, Commissioner, and there is a need to update the fees because as development starts to pick up, we're going to be collecting money, and we want to collect enough money. One of the things, though, that we have to be cautious about is that the dollar amount is correct, and because otherwise it won't face legal scrutiny. And impact fees are usually areas with light targets for litigation. So when we're looking at, one of the reasons we're trying to get some of these details, and I agree with the fact that once we have enough information to move forward, we need to do that so we can collect the increased revenue so the American fees are increased. But one of the problems we have is unless we know like where the location of the parks are going to be in the acreage is, then we can't have an accurate assessment of the value of the land cost. And dependent upon where the park sites end up, we can't really quantify the infrastructure costs, too, that are associated with that. So that's what hurts with that. Now, as far as where we're going with that right now, we're negotiating an agreement that's imminent right now on libraries to have that strategic plan done, which will lead to the master plan. I think maybe Robinson is here somewhere if you have questions on that. On the parks plan, we, as I mentioned earlier, my hope is this negotiation is done very soon, and we'll know what land we're trading when we bring that to council. Even though it's been a delay, I think that if it works, the delay will be worthwhile because we'll be netting out probably another 50 acres or so of parkland for the community, which will be a good thing. And then on the fire master plan is the other one, and that one is actually done. But we need to have the public outreach that's supposed to happen in the next 2 months, and then we should be able to take that one if it is finished, and incorporate public comments and then take it to city council. So I feel the same way you do. I want to make sure that we're collecting the right amount of money so we can build these things for the community. But the time frame we're on should have everything finished by the end of the calendar year. Thank you.
Any other comments?
Thank you. I just have a comment on the notion of parks. You know, we're talking about adding another 240 acres of parks out on the bayfront. So I think once that gets to the level in which you can actually develop a park, one of those predicaments is you can't develop a park until you have the building that will help feed the park. So if construction were to begin, for example, on the Pacifica development in 2016, some monies would be poured into the capacity to have a park, but it takes a good year to get a park up and going. So whoever's sitting around this table in 5 years is going to be looking at a prospect of adding a tremendous number of acres of active space and passive space over on the bayfront. The other is the Otay Valley Regional Park. You know, it's a 15-mile stretch that goes from the Otay Dam clear down to Highway 5. It's a shared JPA. We've had some real successes, I think, working with a couple of foundations, and the ERA grants really helped us out as well. It'll never be a Balboa Park. It's intended to be a wild and woolly park. But I think at some point when you're more comfortable with the timing on that, I think that would reassure not only GMOC but planning that we should have plenty of acres of parks. The next question will be, how do we maintain them as a park? Because they don't just maintain themselves. Any questions or comments on parks and recreation from council? Mr. Ramirez.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Yes, I wanted to respond to you, Commissioner Spethman. What you said, it took me a year and a half after I was elected to office, and I was active in the community before that, but it took me a year and a half after I was elected to figure out that the city of Chula Vista really doesn't have a Parks and Recreation Department. We have a Recreation Department. Christy is the assistant director of that department, and what they do is all the recreation programs the city offers that are listed on the website. I mean, there are hundreds of basketball leagues and yoga classes and all kinds of programs for kids and after school programs. The Recreation Department programs all those programs and oversees them and supervises them and stuff. Parks is really handled as a division within Public Works, And as Christy said, the two communicate all the time, of course, because some of the recreation programs, like you know, a kids' soccer league, takes place in the parks. But we really have just a recreation department. And I've always, once I realized that, which took me a while, because most cities have parks and rec departments, when I look at the threshold standard for what in the GMOC, you know, stratus is parks and recreation, is 3 acres of neighborhood and community parkland with appropriate facilities per 1,000 residents east of 805. So it's really got nothing to do with recreation programs. So I don't know, maybe this is something the members of the GMOC would like to think about, is whether or not that threshold should really be changed to just parks, because it's really not really connected with recreation. So just a thought. I mean, I have the same confusion that you did for a long time. So the other thing I wanted to say about parks is that the standard only addresses parks east of 805. And I'm wondering, again, I guess I want to suggest or request that the members of the GMOC think about the possibility of adding parks citywide to your thresholds. The on the east side, we're doing pretty well with keeping up with the standard, which is 3 acres per 1,000 residents. On the west side, we're woefully behind that. I think I saw the number is 0.9 acres per 1,000 residents, something like that. So, you know, and it's understandable why, because when the west side was built, those standards were not in place, so it just didn't happen. But maybe it's time for the GMOC to actually sort of begin to track new parks on the west side. We have had some in recent years, and some additional ones are planned, like in the Sweetwater Valley. And then, as the mayor said, there are lots of park space on the bayfront. So it's just a thought that I wanted to offer for you guys to think about. And I really like the idea. I can't remember who said it now, but somebody said, maybe we could reconsider, if we could, adjusting the threshold a little bit so that we can count adding facilities to existing parks. And especially on the west side, there are lots of opportunities for dog parks, and dog parks is what I hear about all the time. People want dog parks in existing parks. Just, you know, take a little corner and make a dog park out of it. A lot of the parks on the west side are underutilized because they don't have enough stuff to do in them. So if that could be considered as part of the threshold, adding amenities to existing parks. Somebody suggested that, I forgot who, but whoever, I think it's a great idea, but I think it would require changing the threshold. So those are my comments. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Ramirez?
Well, it's pretty much what I wanted to comment. Can you hear me, John? Yeah. was sort of on the west side. And I guess the first question I have is with regard to Bayfront Park space and or Otay Valley Regional Park space counting as park space for the west side. I remember conversations where we couldn't consider that because it just weren't, it was a city land, I think, or we can clarify that.
Yeah, Madam Mayor, council members, let me take that. The 3 acres per 1,000 in the threshold is basically improved municipal parkland, is what counts. So that's the reason in the case of Otay Valley Regional Park, as Mayor mentioned, majority of it is not counted. There are, however, a few sites within there, like Rios, May Street. There's a future area down near the strawberry fields for, you know, designated in the parks master plan for parks. So those components that are actively developed do get counted. One other thing that goes on with park standards is there's other jurisdictions that do count open space, as Mayor said, you know, natural open space or passive parkland that's not municipal park, but oftentimes their standards may vary. They may be 4 acres, 5 acres, 6 acres per thousand, but they include a wider swath. So there are opportunities, but today the parks on the bayfront that function as municipal parks are counted. Portions of those future parks will be, and then portions of parks that are in Otay Valley Regional Park, those active spots are counted in the threshold.
And I guess we don't measure that currently. I mean, I think we know, and Councilmember Aguilar mentioned a number, a ratio, right, for the west side, but we don't actually count that, and we don't measure that or review it in GMOC.
Correct. So let me respond to that citywide comment that was made earlier. So in the comprehensive review of growth management, which there will be some changes to thresholds coming back to council, making the threshold citywide for new park development. So when you have new population growth, 3 acres per thousand, that would be consistent with the way the parks development ordinance is already drafted today, which if you have development citywide that's new development, you're proportionally paying it, providing park at a 3 acre per thousand rate citywide. So we just need to catch the threshold up with that. On the 0.9 acre figure, I think it's important to remember that the GMOC process was not designed to deal with pre-existing conditions. So we had development for many years since the incorporation of the city in Western Chula Vista that developed either absent standards or when standards first came on board beginning in the late 70s, they started out at 2 acres per thousand and then they grew. So when we do go to measure citywide, I think what we'll be doing is we'll be looking at 3 acres per thousand of new parkland for new population going forward. I think it was mentioned in previous years that we should also, whether or not it's in a threshold, the city council could look at what does it want to do with that pre-existing condition situation, and is there a program that over time supplements that, which is would generally operate outside the thresholds program that's geared just to new development.
Yeah, at least start tracking it.
So.
Yeah, so that's that's an important thing to think about, that you know that your park ratios and your park standards would be for just new development, and I think if I understand you correctly, all pre-existing. So if there's a park space deficit, let's say, for pre-existing conditions, that park deficit will continue, could.
Or as Councilman Aguilar said, absent some concerted effort to try to move towards
try to
bettering that over time.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's good. That could be very good work. Probably not so much necessarily for GMOC, but for planning to help us sort of figure out how we do that. I mean, what should that standard be? As a planning commission, proactively, you know, looking at what are the various options, what are the various constraints to doing that, and coming up with a sensible solution, a sensible standard that we can then GMOC can measure, right, and monitor. I mean, from my point of view, that's kind of the way I think it should happen. And I think that would give Planning Commission some good proactive work to do, I think, in this arena. So I guess those are my comments. Let me ask you on the financial side of the park. That was the thing I was missing here. You know, we get a lot of pressure, and I think you may have had some too with regards to fees, park fees, pad fees for park development. We've heard from developers that we're higher than anybody else in the county, and I'm not sure if that's true, but that's what we hear. And so certainly from the development community, they're saying, wait a minute, it's too much already, and we know that we are, you know, that we have some challenges meeting the particular standards. So that's quite a difficult situation to be in. Do we have any ideas about how to do that? I mean, are we just going to reduce the standard to sort of meet the market requirements of development on the west side, or are we? I mean, I'd be interested in hearing from planning commissioners in particular about that. I mean, where are we in regards to that? Yeah, are we going to look at the impact of additional fees or higher fees, pad fees, in order to achieve a park standard, whatever that might be, or are we staying away from that? Is that going to be too hard?
Madam Mayor, I don't mind jumping in on this one. The Quimby Act is 3 acres per thousand, so we're definitely going to get that. It's self-mitigation on the way forward. Everything that develops is going to happen. In the meantime, we're also looking at opportunities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is the strawberry fields down south. There's other areas. There's the new library park down by the South Library. When those opportunities become available, we'll certainly jump on them. Mm-hmm. Additionally, we're looking at combining both the west and east park fees together. So maybe there's monies that come in on the east side that are used to purchase lands on the west side. Another idea that's being kicked around. But it really comes up with the appraisal for the land and the amount of amenities that we put into it.
And I would, and I'm guessing that that land values on the west side are probably higher than they would be for greenfield.
I've seen appraisals go in both directions, really? Depending on how much brownfield is going on.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Any other comments on parks? Okay, I'm looking at the first hour and knowing that we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So just reminding you of the time. The fiscal item begins on page 1-35. Ms. Calvo, do you have any comments from the Planning Commissioner?
Any of the commissioners have comments?
None from Planning Commissioners. Any comments from council members? None from council members. The next item in compliance is the item on drainage, which begins on page 1-36. Ms. Calvo, do you have any questions or comments from Planning Commissioners? None?
None.
Drainage from council members. Ms. Aguilar.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I think I read in the document that the, this one, the City Council identified funding to. So I was wondering if there's anybody from staff that could say something about where this funding might come from. I mean, this issue of drainage channels is a huge problem in the city. Can anyone enlighten me on that?
Let's see if there's anybody from the engineering department, either Mr. Valley, Mr. Rivera.
No, I mean the funding to implement the program.
I was going to see if he could answer the question.
Okay.
Members of the Council, Commission, and GMOC. On the funding issue, that's the difficult part of what we've been trying to do is that with the unfunded state mandates and the requirements for us to keeping our drainage channels clear, that's where we've been having the difficulty in trying to come up with funding sources that are adequate. With the maintenance, you can only do so much, but it's trying to get well-established and regular funding source for us to continue to get ahead of it. So that's really where
so
the issues.
Kim, can you go back to the recommendation? Yeah. So that's the recommendation: identify funding, and the department is saying that you concur.
That's correct.
But
yes.
But you really don't have any idea
well,
about that.
Well, what's happened also is with the stormwater regulations; those are constantly being updated, and so we come up with ideas and try to get our arms around what our needs are, then the requirements or the interpretations for a higher level of compliance kick in, and it's just a moving target.
So you say you concur, but you don't really have any way
to implement. I concur. We're working on what we can do.
Okay.
At the local level and regional level, we discuss this because it's an issue with all the local agencies
sure.
in the county.
Sure.
But
has anybody looked at, I mean, the city is divided into drainage sheds. Yeah, drainage basins. Has anybody looked at that in terms of a way to assess people so that it wouldn't conflict with Prop 26?
Well, we have some of that with our landscape maintenance districts, but that doesn't cover all the areas.
Okay, so that's maybe one possibility to look
that's
into.
That's correct.
Then. Okay, thank you.
One other predicament on that is Prop 218, which requires a public no protest vote in order to move forward with any additional monies. And the issue of drainage is really complicated because the Regional Water Quality Control Board here in San Diego is looking at upping its requirements, even though they're not necessarily effective in the areas in Chula Vista. And if they don't get off the point where they are now, we could be looking at anywhere from a $10 to $20 million additional hit, for which there is no funding unless we did a Prop 218, which is a real expensive venture. So there's a couple of us going to the Regional Quality Control Board. I mean, at some point, drainage and stormwater all kind of mixed together, because it all is supposed to go down the drain, but cleanly, and the Regional Water Quality Control Board wants to add a lot of requirements to it. So my guess is that next year, when the GMOC looks at this one, you might be looking at a sizable dollar figure as well as some extraordinary requirements. Any other questions from the council? Okay, then we'll move on to schools. Schools, for those following on your iPads or the printed document, begin on 1-37. Thank you, Mr. Rivera. Ms. Calvo?
Commissioner? No.
Council?
Mr.
Ramirez?
Just a quick comment. In some recent community meetings that I was involved in, people, in particular on the east side, don't have the same impression about whether or not growth has been managed well enough with regards to how it impacts schools. It's pretty widely held that schools are overly impacted. I mean, people tell stories of waiting in line to get their kids registered for school, and a lot of that, I think, some of the things I've heard from our staff is that it has to do with some of the school district's policies with regard to open enrollment, but still some serious overcrowding issues, you know, whatever the case is, overcrowding issues in our schools, in particular at some of our better schools on the east side. And so, you know, I mean, I don't know, we don't have a whole lot of jurisdiction over schools, but I mean, any thoughts about that? Are you guys hearing the same thing in the community? Because what we see here is it's covered, it's taken care of, no problem. But what we're hearing on the street is it's quite a bit different. I mean, any ideas to how to address that?
I know.
Mr. Spethman, so make sure that you are Michael Spethman. For the record.
Mike Spethman. I can tell you firsthand that the open enrollment, it's a district issue. We're very aware when we look at a project that comes forward to the Planning Commission, we get a report, we get a staff report for density. We're fully aware of how our decisions have the potential to impact, you know, the school facilities, and we absolutely take that into consideration. But I can tell you, it's a fact that since the district has open enrollment and a student can go anywhere in the district they want to go, the schools are impacted. Some of them are under-enrolled, and a lot of them have way too many students. The district.
Madam Mayor, if I might, Sweetwater School District is limiting open enrollment to the high schools in the east at this time, so it's not going to be as open as it has been in the past.
And Madam Mayor, just we did, so staff does have constant contact with the district. We met with the superintendent and others from both districts. This is primarily related to Sweetwater Union High School District, but my understanding of the current policy is the open enrollment applies is up to the point that the school is enrolled up to 85% of its enrollment capacity, and then at that point they stop open enrollment so that remaining, you know, 15% is available to those who are actually in the attendance area. So, but they're, you know, well aware of what you're hearing, Councilman, out in the community about the effects of that policy.
Commissioner Anaya would like to.
You know, I have to totally agree with my fellow commissioner and Councilman Ramirez. As a parent of a five-year-old, I've stood in that line at 2 in the morning. And the issue is definitely not that there's not enough schools, facilities around. It's the choice that we have as parents to select the school that we prefer our child to go to. And unfortunately, we have no jurisdiction on those schools. I think, Commissioner Sethman said, we look and make sure densities are appropriate around those schools, and unless something can be done to change the quality of some of our schools, at least the perception of some of the quality of the schools. Parents are going to keep impacting certain schools more than others. On both sides, that my child happens to go to a school on the west side that has a significant waiting list to this day. So.
Commissioner Levis?
Yeah, one other thing that to consider, too, is that, and we heard this as we questioned the school district, you know, we lay out our general plan and we have certain densities set, and they then plan accordingly. But what we typically see as time goes on, we increase densities, and then their plans are now out of whack, and they can't go back and easily and reconstruct new plans. So they deal with it with portables and whatnot, and then the cycle kind of turns. And so that contributes it to a certain degree, but I think by far it's more district policies, because there is reported, and you can see in the detail, a lot of schools that are underutilized and other schools are overutilized. So there is some impact in the way we approve plans and how we differ sometimes from the general plan, and we've seen a lot of that creep over the last few years, at least that I've been on, where we're increasing densities and then they're behind the power curve to kind of react because they're going off the forecast. So we have some responsibility to that to some degree, but I think by far the biggest issue that we're seeing is district policy.
Just to weigh in as well, there is a law called SB 50 that as long as the school district indicates that there is space in a school, cities cannot deny them those plans. So you're right, school district decisions, school board decisions make big impacts on numbers of kids in school, but there is a certain limit then that we as a city have. Thank you. Armita, did you have something?
Yes, I have just a quick note. It's also important to note that the report that we're covering today is for the period of 2011 to 12. So the true impact of open enrollment hasn't really been felt yet. I think these findings may change as we move forward.
Anything else from planning or council, Mr. Ramirez?
Yeah, just a final comment on that issue. I mean, is it okay? Should we just let it go? As a city, because it seems like it's not really managed, right? I mean, for a lot of good reasons, you know, state law, you know, what have you. I mean, just the structure of school districts, how they're governed, how we're governed. Is that it? I'm thinking, why are we even measuring it? Why are we even thinking about it? We can't do anything about it anyway.
Well, I know from the school district standpoint, when we met with them, they have open seats. District-wide, there are open seats.
District-wide.
Right. And that's how they measure. So that's what we're bumping up against.
Yeah, and I understand. I mean, sure. But from a planning point of view, that doesn't really help, does it? I mean, if the goal is to have schools that are not impacted, it's not really getting to the goal. Maybe there isn't anything we can do. I'm not sure, but schools are important, right?
Oh yeah.
And they're important to development. They're important to communities. They're important to.
The real concern is, as we start building again on the east side, who's going to buy a home if they've got to ship their child off to a school that's across town? That's the real issue, as far as planning is concerned.
Okay. I don't think this is an issue we want to give up on or take off the table. I think there's opportunities they're switching personalities on me. There's opportunities certainly with GMOC to build a relationship with the facility people at the high school district, for Planning Commission to look at, be aware of when the next school is coming on board. But you're right, the market's going to help this. You know, we've got some constraints. School districts have constraints. I'm not going to bore you with the state law regarding school transfers and what school districts have to say. Fact of the matter is we want to be known as a city with good parks, strong libraries, good schools, places where families want to come and live and be happy. So with that, we'll go on to sewer. I thought that was pretty brilliant. Ms. Calvo, any comments from your side on sewer?
None. Thank you.
In the famous words of Mr. Ramirez, we just like to flush and forget about it. Any comments from council? Yeah, he's never going to live that one down. Yeah, it was you. It was.
We always wanted to go in one direction, and that is away.
Okay. All right. The final issue that is on the compliant list is air quality, which, for those of you following along, begins on page 1-39. Ms. Calvo?
Commissioners?
Members of the council? Ms. Bensusan?
In regards to air quality, I received a alert press release letter Tuesday, I guess it was, from the California EPA Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, and this is an alert notifying the mapping that they've recently done that identifies California communities most burdened by multiple pollutants, and they look at and collect data on 11 types of pollution and 7 population characteristics and socioeconomics to create scores for each zip code. And what the news relevant to Chula Vista in this study that was just released is that 91911 zip code is in the highest 10% in the state, statewide, for combined burdens and vulnerabilities from pollution. So this is a really significant, we've never been on the map in terms of the 10 most impacted communities in the state. So we're going into the new period, we need to look at that 91911 zip code and the EPA report. And what they do with this data that they study and then release in terms of the scoring by zip code, the idea is to help direct resources that are desperately needed to reinvest in California's most polluted and economically struggling neighborhoods. So the bad news is that we're like almost as bad as, we place almost as bad as Barrio Logan, one of the worst in the state. And the good news is that there may be some opportunities for funding and resources. We may get a bigger share that we can then direct to improving this problem, this condition.
Thank you. Mr. Vinson, did you have a question?
You didn't. Did they spell out a reason for the condition of 919?
Well, it's
factory
it's
or the.
I'm sure if you go down into the weeds of the report, there may be that information. I just got the letter, the announcement letter, and then I got a link to a map that shows all the zip codes and the worst zip codes in the state, and you know they've organized it by percentages, so. The report has just come out, but I think that would be important for the GMLC to look into and to go deep down into the weeds of the information.
Might I ask, do you share that report with me? The
sure.
The address?
Sure. I'll forward you the. I got it by email, so I'll forward it to you.
How about if we do this, Ms. Bensusan? Could you forward that report to Ms. Vanderby? And then Ms. Vanderby can send it out to everybody and decide how much of it you want to read. Okay? That moves us to the last of the issues that are compliant, and that's the issue of water, which begins on page 1-40. This is a compliant issue, and here this evening is Mr. Mark Watton from the Otay Water District. Should we have specific questions of Otay? Is anybody here from Sweetwater? Well, then you can answer for them too, Mark. Okay. Ms. Calvo, water.
Commissioner? No, none.
Council members. Well, I've got to tell you that what was not named in the report, because it's still sort of in the thinking stages, is the plant, the desal plant that Otay is looking at in Rosarita Beach. So it certainly would suggest that as you look to your, what do you call it, top to bottom, bottom to top, you know, your two-way study, that you think about inviting Mark Watton out. I'm sure he'd entertain you probably for a good hour on where OTI sees themselves, where they think that this will benefit not only Chula Vista and their service area, but also Mexico. So as long as you're not leaving, I'm going to say something nice about you when we get to traffic, but if you're leaving now, then I got to say it now. You want to get out of here? Okay. All right. I'm just going to say it now. I'm going to put him on the spot. Yeah. We're going to get to traffic, but I want you to know that these flyers are just symptomatic of the kinds of things that Sandag's putting out in order to promote using 125. And yesterday, Mr. Watton agreed to put these in the billing statements for the zip codes that are most closely impacted by that, and we appreciate that very much. Okay, we'll now go to the issues of non-compliance. The first one is libraries. Ms. Calvo?
Commissioners, any comments on libraries?
Council? Ms. Aguilar?
Yeah, on the libraries, this is the one that has been out of compliance for the longest, and as far as I can tell, is the one that it's maybe, except for drainage, it's going to be the one that's going to be most difficult to get to where we need to be because of lack of money to build libraries. So, one of the things that concern me is that in the report, you the GMOC. If you can pull up the thank you. So you're recommending that the library facilities master plan, which is underway, that it include interim and long-term solutions to bring the library system into conformance. And then the staff response was that you're going to do strategic visioning. So I just didn't get the connect between what they're requesting and the response. So is the library master plan going to look at a plan to bring the library threshold into conformance?
Because the library director, Betty Wassman, is here to respond. Ms. Wassman?
Yes, and I'm sorry that I could have been a little bit more verbose in my response. You may remember that the library facilities master plan draft has been completed. It was scheduled for council in July of 2011. It happened that it was came up at a very crowded agenda, and the request was made at that point that it be postponed. While the date was being set for a new presentation to council, the request came that not just merely an analysis of facilities, but really a look at what is library service in the 21st century, what do we want the library to do, that would be a valuable component in addition to kind of a prologue or a first chapter to that. And so that's what we've been working on. And the library facilities master plan with the strategic visioning component will contain short and long-term solutions to bring the library into compliance.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to know, because your answer really didn't quite say that, so thank you for that. I also wanted to say that, you know, I've said this before, and I think Ms. Dominguez has said it as well, if I remember correctly, but it's always seemed to me that, you know, we don't have enough library space, and yet we have recreation centers that are underutilized. So, you know, in heaven, you know, if we were in heaven, those two facts in themselves would present a logical, resolution. Now, I know it's more complicated than that because there's staffing and all kinds of issues involved, but I don't know to what extent that will be addressed in the library facilities master plan, because it's got to do with the rec centers. But I'm hoping that one of the things that will be considered is there a way, and I don't know the answer to this, but is there a way to help make up for the lack of library space by using some of the rec centers? And there are many more rec centers citywide than there are libraries.
So if you have any response, I'd love to hear it.
Yes, I do. I appreciate that point of view, and you, you certainly, you can look at the city landscape and see the picture you're describing.
Yes.
We have been careful in our, we feel that we've been careful in our choice of consultants. The strategic visioning plan contract is just about ready to go, and we actually have a company on board that has a lot of experience with joint library recreation facilities, joint municipal facilities of all kinds. They have a lot of experience. They're very excited about the possibility of, you know, reimagining some of our spaces.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, we recently described to council some of the collaborations that we have, you know, on the very most basic level, not really requiring a retooling of a facility. So we're aware that that might be a great way to leverage our resources. We're certainly very open to it.
Thank you.
I know that you and I have talked with, along with City Manager and Dr. Melinda Nish from Southwestern College, and I'm understanding at this point that those conversations with the librarian haven't taken place, even though you've done the outreach. But you expressed at a meeting how the change in libraries is going to take place over the next 5, 10, 20 years that aren't going to be building specific. Do you have just a minute or two where you can talk about the notion of a research center?
Right. I would say that, you know, just like probably everybody in this room, we're definitely in a transition period. What I would say is that the library is proving every day that it's more than books, that I do encounter people on, you know, a regular basis that express their sympathy to me that I'll be out of a job shortly and there's no, you know, libraries are all going to close. But what we really find is that people want the library more than ever. They want a space. They need a place dedicated to their better selves, place that's open to everybody, where we support all points of view and everyone is welcome, where the community can gather in a neutral space that doesn't require you to buy a cup of coffee or, you know, pledge to a creed, and that's what we are finding that we're thriving at. So the idea of incorporating 21st century technologies into this space, to have maker spaces where people can create their own content, where you're our individual unique selves, you know, here in Chula Vista, the fact that we have the Heritage Museum and the local history collection, that's something that the library is particularly suited to do. The fact that what the library offers are skilled professionals that can help individuals navigate the internet, that we have the same technologies that are available in the private sector, that is to say, downloadable ebooks, live online help for homework. We need to be in the mobile world. That's where everybody is. All my colleagues are back there on their phones right now, following along with the discussion here. And if we're not where the public has no use for us. So we have mobile apps. We have ways to interface with each other. We're developing a social media on our catalogs. You can comment on the books that you've read that, you know, you'd like to see. So that's some of the things that we're doing that we would like to be able to do to make sure that we're still relevant to the people here in Chula Vista.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rosnes. Mr. Ramirez?
Yeah, they're all back there watching Tuesday's
No,
City Council
not
meeting.
At all.
No,
not
no.
at all.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The problem really isn't space, right, but staffing.
You know, it certainly is operational. One reason that we haven't come back to you immediately with the strategic visioning plan is that we thought we had a golden opportunity. The fact that we had this new model of library service out of the Otay Ranch Town Center, smaller, streamlined, very, you know, not just in case but just in time type of service model. We want to see what that was like. What was it like to have something really small? Could you still serve people? Well, we have found that even though there's things we can't do, there's a lot we can do. People really respond to a lot of other aspects of the service that we can offer. So in a sense, you could say space is not necessarily the issue, but I think place is an issue. People want a place to go. I mean, why do people go to a coffee shop when they can be on their laptop at home? They want something around them. They want an atmosphere that supports their efforts, and the library is great for that. So, you know, we're not ready to shut the doors and put everything online, but staffing is, it's critical. We do have just like many of my colleagues here, we have a very low staffing level, one of the lowest in the state. And so that does really impact our ability to give the kind of service that we want.
Yeah. So, and just quickly on space and place, is geography something that's important? As you see kind of in the trends, is the sort of the placement, the location of the of libraries still important? Do people want them in close proximity to their homes, or is a, you know, the central library kind of concept a better concept?
You know, I think it really depends on other circumstances. Are you looking at a city with a lot of transportation needs, or is, you know, are people mobile in their cars? I think that it's also incumbent on anybody running a system like ours to think of what you can really support. Just as we see with school districts across the country, is the enrollment so low a school needs to close? That's such a heartbreak. We would never want to see the same thing here in Chula Vista, where, I mean, just what we've gone through, where we have more facilities than we can support. The result that they're open 2 days a week, and what kind of facility is that? So at a certain point, it makes more sense to aggregate your space. It's cheaper to run it. But, you know, we do have a big city. It's a pretty big geography. So there's a midline there, I think, between having one place that's the most cheapest to run, but people have to go the farthest to, and to have multiple facilities you can't really support.
Is that going to be part of the
vision? I hope so, right.
Ms. Watson, I would really like to encourage cooperation with other institutions of learning like Southwestern College. I know we had a model at Eastlake High that wasn't, it didn't quite make it, and it didn't quite make it because the library was internal in the campus, and the hours were not convenient for our readers, for our users. There was confusion about when they could go to the library, when it was off limits. But certainly I think that having a partnership with Southwestern College and our future universities, I think that that will be the type of gathering space that will really attract and draw a lot of users to the library. Just just making sure that we don't make the same mistakes of the past, that we have equal access to any partnership that we have with an institution of higher learning. But I certainly think that that way we can not only get more bang for our buck, but make sure that both the institution of learning and the library system has the opportunity to have just the utmost technology and programs that will be attractive to a continually changing population.
Thank you very much, Betty. You want to give a plug for Bon Appetit this Saturday? Go on, be shameless. It's okay.
Thank you.
I'll have company.
You know, they do say, Mayor, the Pentagon doesn't have to run lemonade stands, but libraries do. So this is our funding fallback. Yeah, you're all invited. I know many of you will be there. The library is having a fundraiser right outside our beautiful award-winning Otay Ranch Library, Saturday night, 5 to 9. Bon Appetit. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you very much. We'll move on now to the threshold police. This is priority one and priority two, neither of which are compliant. Just to add another definition to what priority one and priority two are, priority one is the robber is in my house. Priority two is the robber has been in my house. So it gives you an idea. Yolanda.
Commissioner?
Yeah.
Commissioner Spethman?
I don't see Chief Bejarano here. Captain Wedge?
Captain Wedge is here.
Okay. I'll wait for you to come up. Okay. The 15th year in a row, priority two is non-compliant. What do you attribute that to?
Well, there are a variety of factors. I think we've looked at this every year. When we looked at staffing, strictly as staffing is an issue, we felt that the number of officers we would need to hire was unreasonable to fall within that threshold, which I think is one of the reasons that the recommendation coming before you will be to change that threshold, put it more in line with county norms.
Priority two also includes burglar alarms, security alarms, false alarms, correct?
Currently, the burglary alarms have been changed to a priority three.
Is that new?
Recent, within the last few months. But during this period of time,
the
threshold was measured.
Okay.
It was priority two.
It was priority two when the threshold was measured. Okay, and I noticed. Real quick, I'm gonna go to the GMOC commissioners. Priority three. I mean, is that this year that priority three? Is this something you guys came up with? I was only aware of priority one and priority two.
There is no threshold standard for priority three.
Priority three are typically much lower priority calls. We also have priority four calls.
So this is priority three is not something that GMOC even looks at in terms of terms of numbers, in terms of statistics and all that. Okay,
that's
I gotcha. Captain, I noticed in the staff presentation there was a mention of security alarms, and I know that you guys have had major issues with false alarms, and it takes officers off the street and when they can be doing something much more important. And I saw the number 75%. Am I understanding correctly that 75% of those will not be responded to?
The numbers, we will be going to council, I believe it's on May 21st, with a revised alarm ordinance that has a variety of changes that we believe will lower the number of false alarms we respond to. You may be aware that about 99.7% of the alarms we respond to are false. And again, what we are doing, this came out of one of the recommendations out of the Matrix study that was done recently. The independent consultant hired to look at patrol staffing as well as a more comprehensive organizational review. One of their recommendations was to go to some type of verified alarm response. Now, we have done outreach. We have met with a number of people, looked at some options, looked at working with a third-party vendor to address the issue of false alarms, and these recommendations will come to council in May, late May.
Is one of those recommendations going to be fee-based?
There will be a change in the fee structure. That's correct.
Okay. Priority one, what do you attribute the non-compliant? Why are we not compliant with priority one? I mean, that's our number one response.
That's correct. As we've heard this evening, the city has gone through a significant reduction over the last several years. Last year, when this analysis was done, we were at the tail end of a significant reduction in staffing. Now, we believe that the changes that we have made since the beginning of this year, and actually some of the hiring that began in the latter part of 2012, calendar year 2012, will get us back up to that number. And actually, irrespective of the change in thresholds for priority twos, would actually bring us even closer there.
Okay, because, I know that you guys had a lot of your upper-level staff that retired. So based on what you're forecasting with these new recruits coming in and lateral moves from other departments, people transferring, how soon do you think that we're going to be able to bring our level of response up?
I think if we were to look at it now and just do an analysis of the last few months, you would have seen it. You would see a change from when this analysis was done. In January, we changed our deployment, our staffing model for patrol, which has increased staffing on the weekends rather significantly. We have also moved our street team temporarily back into patrol for those non-weekend nights until we can hire the vacancies, fill the vacancies that currently exist. One of the other big recommendations that came out of the Matrix study that we have implemented, again only at the beginning of this year, was the addition of community service officers. These are the non-sworn civilian employees who take a number of crime reports. I think at our peak many years ago when we had 5 or 6 CSOs in patrol, they handled about 5 or 6,000 crime reports. Every one of those crime reports without a CSO is a report that would have to be taken by a sworn officer, which means logically your response times would be longer because you have to clear an officer from that call or wait until the officer clears depending on the nature of that call. So the CSOs alone will have a significant impact. We have 2.5 CSOs, 2 of them, the full-time CSOs, recently completed training. The third CSO, the half-time position, is in training now. So a combination of a variety of things. We've also brought several officers back from task force positions. We felt that it was time to right size the task forces. Some of those positions were filled because other agencies had pulled away, and when we were trying to avoid layoffs, because some of those positions came with funding offsets, we moved them into the task forces. We are now in a position where we need to bring them back, and that's what we have done as well.
How many graduate cadets are now working for the department, and how many more are going to be coming online, and when?
When you say graduate cadets, are you referring to recruit entry-level police officers?
Correct.
We currently have 2 recruits in the academy. We could have a very lengthy discussion about standards and about post-state requirements and things like that. It is very, very challenging to find well-qualified candidates. We will not lower our standards to bring people into the organization. So for 200-300 applicants, we're lucky if we get 2 or 3 well-qualified candidates. Keep in mind that the hiring of recruits, and actually laterals for that matter, only ramped up towards the latter part of 2012, again beyond this threshold measurement period. We have 2 other laterals who will be starting May 3rd. These are officers who come to us from San Diego PD. They will be out in the field much sooner. Somebody who's a recruit takes 6 months of the academy, then another 5 months in the field. So it's a combination of the hiring. We have moved another agent into background, so we now have 2 people focused full-time exclusively on conducting background. Again, it takes a while to ramp up this hiring, this recruiting, this background machine that really was dormant for a period of time because of the downsizing. Now that we have done that, combined with the moves that have been made over the last 4 to 5 months, we believe that will have a significant impact.
Great. Thank you, Captain.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Any other commissioner have a comment? No, thank you.
Thank you. Council comments, priority 1 or priority 2, Mr. Ramirez?
Well, you know, a tough situation that we're in with regard to our police. I mean, and it's actually something that I'm having a little bit of trouble with our management versus our rank and file PD. I've been talking with those folks a lot, and what they say about what's going on out in the community and in the streets and their ability to respond is quite a bit different from what I get from management. I mean, I think there was a, I haven't seen it, but I heard about your op-ed talking about, you know, statistics in our city and how, you know, we're statistically rank amongst, you know, the lowest crime rates in the county and, you know, across. And so there's that. And I think that's, I mean, when you look at Sandag numbers and some other numbers, that's what it indicates. But you know, what I'm getting from the folks in the field and what I'm getting from just citizens and my own personal experiences, there's something going on, and I can't quite put my finger on it, but there's a huge disconnect. Just this morning, at 7 o'clock in the morning, I was pulling out of my driveway, and my neighbor across the street came over to tell me about some issues. He's the guy that's retired. He's the guy that watches over, you know, the neighborhood. Everybody's got somebody like that. Hopefully everyone's got somebody like that in their neighborhood. But so he comes over to tell me all these things. And so, I like I said, it's troubling, and it's a difficult, difficult problem because it's, I mean, if we had all the money in the world, you know, we'd hire a bunch more cops and we'd have, you know, we'd have it all. But it's a problem because we're trying to balance, you know, the needs of our PD with, you know, what we're hearing from Betty and Christy on our rec departments and libraries, and you know, everything's important and we want it all, but something's got to give because and what I want to see, because I recognize the difficulty of this problem, but what I would like to see is a convergence of that, you know, so that we're all talking about what's really happening out there and there's some common understanding of the challenge that we're facing, as opposed to what it feels like to me is going on now, that we have you know, two sort of very different perspectives out there. It would be helpful for me as somebody who has to make those decisions about where we need to spend money to understand that at a better level. And I guess that's a comment that I want to make all of you aware of, because I don't know how much contact you have with, you know, rank and file PD, you know, or what your own personal experience on. But that is something that's going on in this city right now that is a serious issue. And, you know, I didn't know this. I didn't know before today. I didn't know that we weren't even making priority one calls. So it's, with our own statistics and our own information gathering, we're, I think, identifying a different situation than what we're getting really from our folks. And you know, it's just maybe just a difference of opinion, or, you know, who knows, but it's something that's out there, something I think we need to deal with.
Can I comment quickly on that? I think it's important to understand that ultimately we all want the same thing. We management want what the POA wants. We want what the community wants. This is a significant transition, and adjustments obviously would be necessary. Those adjustments are being made. And I understand the frustration with the pace at which hiring is occurring, but there are a number of reasons for that. I've shared some of those in my comments. But it's also important to realize that we have been down this road before. There have been periods of time, late 90s, I believe, where our staffing numbers, the gap between the authorized level and the actual number of officers we had was significant. And understandably so, there was concern about the speed at which we were hiring people. Again, we're not going to lower our standards. We'll get there. The same thing I share with the officers, I will share with the people in this room. Allow us the opportunity to make those adjustments. Allow us the opportunity to hire the people we're authorized to hire. And then if those problems continue to exist, we'll reexamine, we'll reevaluate. But right now, the steps that need to be done are being made, are being taken.
Captain Wedge, can I ask you a question about a chart that has call volume? Looking at the number of calls that were made in, say, 2006, 2007, we're looking at the calls were in the 70s, 70,000s, and now the call volume is 64,000. And yet, since 2002 to 2012, that 10-year period, the population certainly has grown. What would you attribute to that volume of calls dropping by 7,000 calls over 10 years when we know our population has increased probably a whole lot more than 7,000?
That's a great question. You know, I wish we could take credit entirely for what has caused that change. Just like with statistics, you want to be careful when you're talking about taking credit for statistics. But there have been a number of things that this department has done over the years. As long as I've been a part of the city, we have had a very positive relationship with the community. Those community outreach programs have continued and actually have strengthened. Focus on specific problems, although we're not there yet with our domestic violence grant. Again, it's a hiring issue. But that will address a specific problem, domestic violence. Domestic violence is one of the more prevalent calls for service. So you would expect to see, at least as it relates to domestic violence, those calls to go down as well. So there are a number of factors, any one that may be more significant than the other, but you're correct. We have seen a drop in citizen-initiated calls for service over the last several years.
I'm just looking in the last 5 years, call volume of 74,000 down to 64,000. I mean, I'm thinking if people are calling all the time, it's because they don't feel safe. They must, the residents. And I certainly understand an employee group feeling like they don't have enough people to help share the job, but we've got that in almost every department in the city. I think the other thing that my estimate is that the police department has been pretty nimble with trying to figure out a different way to do something. When you see a problem, you don't wait for the city manager to ask you to fix it. You guys look internally and figure out a solution that'll work for now. So I've just got to say I applaud you for doing the best you can, and we're never going to be able to afford a cop on every corner. It's just not going to work. But if we have the people who know what they're doing and a community who wants to be safe, I don't know that we'll be into compliance on priority one calls next year, but I can certainly say that the staff report, the GMOC study certainly indicates that the hybrid schedule that you have implemented as a department earlier this year seems to be headed in the right direction. So thank you. Any other comments on police? Mr. Ramirez?
Just another quick one, just to come back at you a little bit, Mayor, on that point, and thank you for acknowledging how statistics in this arena are kind of tricky, and you got to be careful about it. I mean, there is another perspective on why calls for service come down. There are folks that believe that the population becomes complacent and sort of accepting of certain conditions in their community, which is a bad direction to go. I mean, and what I hear again from sort of rank and file folks, they experience that a lot. So even though a call will come in, officers will go out, and people are just so disgusted that they're so darn late that they just say, "Forget it, go away. We don't need you anymore." And so that might be something. But now changing the subject a little bit to alarms, because that's something that's coming up, and we've been dealing with this for years. You know, this statistic that 99.6% of those calls are false is something that we've known for years and have talked about that. And the resistance to that, let me just tell you, has been political. Strictly from a management resource allocation point of view, you wouldn't dedicate the resources that we now dedicate to 99.6% false calls. You just wouldn't do it. It doesn't make sense. But the political problem with telling folks in the community that you're no longer going to respond to an alarm is, you know, a very tough hurdle for a lot of groups and a lot of institutions, and that's been a problem here. And one of the things I think that we haven't done that we should do in order to deal with this is to get that, to communicate that that information more. I mean, this fact that, I mean, how many of you knew that 99.6% of alarms in the city were false? Is that? Yeah. Pretty much everyone gets it that's a serious issue, something that I think a communication strategy that needs to go out, I think, to address some of the political concerns and the political sort of breaks that we've put on dealing with this issue. So
one of the things I would like to see us do again that we haven't done for several years, largely because of the budget, is another resident opinion survey. Consistently, we did resident opinion surveys, which showed our strengths, identified areas that perhaps we could do better in, and we just haven't done it. And I think if you see that, you will see that, generally speaking, the community feels safe. This is a safe community. I've been blessed to have some of the most talented professionals in the industry working for our department. You have all have the good fortune of having those individuals here. And sometimes it takes something like a resident opinion survey to validate that perception.
Mr. Sandoval?
Yeah, just a few comments. First of all, I think Councilmember Ramirez is correct. It's not only the community being safe, we want people to feel safe too. Both of those things are important. But I think we have made a lot of progress. One thing is, Captain Wedges said, we are very picky on who we hire as police officers, extremely picky. And there's two reasons. One is a customer service orientation. The other, I'll be real candid with you, is liability. You know, we go in closed session from time to time on lawsuits that involve police officers, and 9 times out of 10 officers did the right thing. But still, that's an area that's right, so we need to be very careful about that. There's also been challenges to getting these things taken care of. We have labor contracts with our police union that doesn't allow us to make changes to schedules without their approval. So that took us about a year to get this through, and it took us a significant amount of money to get this through, but we now have the 312 scheduling that the captain referred to, and the officers like it, and it's really making a difference. Our council saw an issue last year, and they allocated $2.4 million extra dollars to police. And what we did is we did it the smart way. We could have just said we're going to add a bunch of police officers, but instead we did looked at it and followed the matrix standards, which basically had us, as Gary said, add CSOs to do report writing, so that the officers can be out in the field doing their job, which is you know, what they're best at. We changed the way the watch commanders deploy units and how long they're there. We made changes to the way dispatch happens, and really I think we're smarter in how we approach those things. As far as the hiring goes, you know, it's all, you know, they always say it takes a village. Well, it takes a whole city departments. You know, one of the concerns we had in getting these positions full is we were very careful when we went through cuts to really limit public safety. But when you cut over half your HR department, who processes the applications? So we found ways around that. We brought in people as volunteers. We're moving quickly. We're getting really extensive in our outreach, and I'll be actually sending a memo to council tomorrow and being very aggressive in bringing officers in. We're adding, you know, everybody's looking for good police officers. Now the county is, city of San Diego. So the other thing we've done is, with council's blessing, is provide a small bonus to get officers in here, kind of recruitment bonus, and we think that's going to help. So we're making good progress. We're starting to fill the positions. Finally, one thing I didn't know, because I'm a layman, but we found out when we had Matrix work with us, is you know, you could add 200 more cops, and it's not going to stop crime. And when you look at the priority two calls, those are crimes that already occurred. It makes people feel good when they get to your house, but the problem has already occurred. So we need to look at this as how do we make the community safer, community-wide, with everybody working together. And one of the things that we learned is having more, what's the term? I don't know why it just slipped my head.
Proactive
time is what we need. And that's the time the officer can spend when he's not on a call, not at lunch, but other time to go out. And we can use them strategically to work with the community at that time. And with the support we got from the council to be able to add these positions strategically and the other changes we've made, we feel pretty good. We were at a standard of about 22% proactive time. You know, 37% is pretty good. We think we're going to be able to hit over 40%, which is a good mark. But we won't really know till about August. What we're doing is we start implementing these changes in January. Our staffing is coming on board. And our hope is to have all that data in around June or July, and then have Matrix, who's better at than we are, measure where we are in proactive time. And our plan is this summer to have a workshop and give council that information. Everybody can talk about where things are headed. So I know it's a little long-winded. I apologize, but I wanted to give a full answer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sandoval. Thank you, Captain Wetch.
Thank you.
Now we're down to 8 minutes. If we stayed by our timeline, and two more items. Does anybody want to take a 10, 15-minute break, or you want to charge right through? All I heard was one charge right through. Charge. Oh, good. Okay. Nordstrom, here we come. All right. On the item on traffic. Yeah. Traffic. Ms. Calvo.
Commissioners?
No. Council? I just want to bring up, again, the 125. Not only is Sandag issuing cards like these, and I mean, I've got a trunk full of them everywhere I go. I'm putting them out and asking people to consider this. But if you listen to 92.5, the X-Man is doing PSAs for us. So there's a lot of work that's going into making sure people understand the tool. And I know that GMOC's work on 125 and its estimation was really for 2012. I got some stats from Sandag this morning. The trips were 18% higher in February than the February before. Year-to-date, 21% higher than they were in the same period. The record week was on March 10th this year, and the record Friday was March 15th. So Sandag is pleased that the traffic on the toll road is meeting the projections, which were you got to collect enough tolls to make sure you can pay the mortgage. Well, there's no more foreclosures or short sales that goes here, but there's another component, and I don't know when GMOC might want to pick it up or if it's something you even want to talk about picking it up. We look at highways, we look at public transit, and we look at local streets and roads. And a component of that, when you have traffic that works, is particularly with a 125, you take cars off Olympic Parkway, L Street, H Street. You get that traffic moving more dependably, and obviously with the fast track it can move faster. But a portion of that too is making sure that we're conscious of pedestrian ability and bicycling ability. So as you look at this, I'm not suggesting that you add it to your massive list of things to do, but traffic is more than single vehicle occupancy. And if we're going to get rid of or reduce the number one pollution emitting component of traffic, it's the single passenger vehicle. So I appreciate the work that you've done. Wanted to reassure you that Sandag's headed in the right direction, and lots of us are hoping that Heritage Road gets built, because that's going to mean a real boon for people and their cars. Ms. Torres, do you have a comment from one of your members?
Commissioner Danfield.
Thank you. You know, I moved to Chula Vista 23 years ago to 91911, so that explains my emphysema. But I'm very concerned about the cumulative effect of the density increases, and also the that creates traffic on from the new development at Olympic Point and Village 2, because those are coming on right now. They're being rented and they're selling units right this minute. So on Olympic Parkway, we are getting a really stressful situation. And I hear this from the people in eastern Chula Vista, and they're impacted by the schools, and they're impacted by traffic, and that's very frustrating. So I find that it's kind of disingenuous to think that Heritage Road, which is years away, it hasn't been, nothing's been started there, is going to solve all the problems of traffic. But how I feel is that we're kind of going through growing pains in Chula Vista. And a lot of that is from Otay Ranch. So I'm hoping that we can get some kind of a public workshop to let the people know in eastern Chula Vista that we do have a plan to solve some of these issues that impact their life in a negative way.
I think staff is planning on bringing up a workshop perhaps in September, early part of October, where we can have a public workshop to that. Mr. Rivera?
Yes, Mayor and members of the commissions and council. On the response to Commissioner Dansu, Caltrans is going to be starting work next week on the I-805 East Palomar Street direct access ramp project, and we'll start seeing the contractor start to move the equipment on there. That'll provide another access point for Chula Vista. And on the Olympic Parkway, yes, the volumes are about 10% over the design capacity. With the addition of the East Palomar Street 805 access ramp, that'll divert some of the traffic to Palomar Street. Same thing with Telegraph. Telegraph also has quite a bit of traffic on it. And the arterial roadway system we have in the city works as a network, and we have been working with our counterparts at Sandag and at Caltrans to expedite the projects as best we can. And it is a system, as the mayor said, that combination of mass transit and the highway system and the local streets to try to make it all work together.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ramirez.
Just a quick question, Frank, since you're up there. With regards to the purchase of SR-125, I've heard some sort of conflicting information about that. Did the 805 lose improvements as a result of the purchase, the reallocation, I guess, of Sandag funds for the SR-125 purchase?
The way the planning works for the region, projects are planned a decade at a time.
Uh-huh.
And the improvements that were planned for 805 for this decade that were in the 2020 to 2030, the lanes and the improvements that are planned for 805 will be done. I think where we're going to see a difference is going to be beyond 2020 to 2030, where some of the needs for some of the improvements on 805 that were planned to happen earlier may be pushed out further because the traffic will have shifted over more towards SR-125.
They're not exactly lost, they're postponed.
Right. And we look at it every 4 years when the region updates their regional transportation plan. We look at that again, and it's a fresh look at what do we need, what data do we have, which projects need to shift in priority. So as of today, the thinking is, yes, with the purchase of SR-125 about a year and a half ago, it looks as though some of the earlier improvements we were going to get on 805 are going to be pushed out, but we're always adjusting to where the needs are.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And just because some of the comments that I've heard with regards to that particular purchase, and actually this was just recently, because I had always understood that there were not going to be any impacts. And I guess maybe I got lost on that detail about sort of the short term versus the long term. But that it's a little unfair, that people think that it's a little unfair that South Bay is impacted in that way, that we don't get the freeway space that, for example, North County gets with the 15 corridor, but instead our residents have to get shifted to a toll road, right, which they have to pay for, to use. It's not the case in North County. And so just an issue, that's been identified out there.
Well, maybe when people do bring that up to you, you can explain to them that at one point the freeway that was now 125 was indeed a freeway, and Senator Wadi Detta was asked by residents of the community to petition the governor to take it off the freeway system. So as soon as traffic started building up, we no longer had a highway system. And if you do the no roads, slow roads, toll roads formula, this had to be a toll road. I agree with you. I don't like Chula Vistans to have to pay for a toll. But by paying for that toll and by getting the traffic up and by dropping the amount of tolls, we will have purchased a $641 million asset for $341 million.
Isn't it a fact, though, that in order for people to be able to use the 15 lanes, they have to pay?
They do. On the back of the Lucy card. Highway 15's HOV lanes,
right,
or express lanes would use the same transponder,
right,
as ours. Thank you.
Madam Mayor, we have a couple of comments. Commissioner Harry?
We had talked before about open enrollment, and we haven't really looked at the impact it has on traffic. But when you think about it, if somebody's coming from west of 805 to deliver a student to eastern Chula Vista, they're traveling in both directions, and then they're adding to the impact trying to get back on the freeway. So, I mean, I think we know, or at least we're assuming, that we've seen traffic impacts around the schools on the east side. But what we really don't know is how open enrollment affects that.
And Commissioner Encarnacion.
Just a quick comment. I think one of the things that I find is missing, too, when you're looking at traffic is the number one way of reducing traffic is having people not have to drive so far to go to work. And again, I'm new to this process, but I know I've talked to staff, and I really think that's something that the GMOC should look at is really how do we look at and consider economic development impact on each of the thresholds, because there should be a thread, I think, that's woven in, including schools as well. Schools need funding. Our parks need funding. All of our planning, our traffic needs funding. Where is that economic development thread? So I just a quick comment in terms of really for traffic, it's a job issue. It's not necessarily to stop building. Still going to have people on the road going to
work. That's one of the anticipations of the University Research Center, is to hit exactly what you're talking about, getting people in jobs closer to home. We expect to see maybe some lesser traffic on 125, but that should also be concomitant with lesser traffic on local roads, because people are just getting there right from Chula Vista. Thank you. If there are no other questions on traffic, we are going to move to the very last. Thank you very much, Frank. This is fire, begins on page 1-31. Mr. Spethman, would you take the mic in from Ms. Calvo?
Did any of the commissioners have any questions regarding fire? Commissioner Vinson?
The chief still here?
Yes.
Dave? Happy birthday.
Oh, wow.
Thank you for sharing it with us tonight. I just have a question with regards to the First Watch 911 dashboard program. And right now, I guess our dispatch is shared with San Diego, or we're in an agreement with San Diego for dispatch. So right now the calls come in and they're dispatched to the closest service unit available, right?
Madam Mayor and members of council, Commissioner, you're correct. That's the two part of the question is we contract with San Diego City for our dispatch services,
right.
And so they send the closest unit to our calls within the city. We have, in essence, dropped boundary lines between San Diego and National City and so forth. And one of the new things that is happening is National City, as of July 1st, is moving over to San Diego Dispatch as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we will get those mutual aid or automatic aid resources from National City quicker because we won't have to go through two dispatch centers. The other part of that question had to do with the First Watch program.
Right.
First
right.
Watch program is a computer data system that we have now that is tied to our San Diego dispatch program that will allow us to have real-time awareness of when we are having problems meeting our threshold. How that works is that if one of our units gets dispatched and heads out to a call and didn't meet one of the thresholds, for example, our turnout time of responding or getting on scene within the 7 minutes, our on-duty battalion chief will get paged immediately to make them aware of the situation, which might mean moving companies around or if other companies are in doing training or some other activity, they can bring them back into service so that any correction of that would occur. So it gives us the ability to monitor in a real-time sense what is happening that we don't have now. We do monthly reports typically now, so we may be able to correct it. Our threshold and the amount that we are off on that, how we can control that really is the minute or two that we have to be able to respond. Because we're isolated to two areas. One, our dispatch is only going to be as fast as our dispatch will take the call in and take and give us the dispatch to go to the call, and that's a period of about a minute or so. And then we have control over the time it takes us to get out to the call. So the assumption or the baseline for all of our calls is that everybody is sitting in the fire stations doing absolutely nothing and ready to go. But that's not the reality of it. Day to day, our firefighters have to train during the day. They also have obligations to go out to their districts and do inspections and other activities. And so they're always moving about, which take away from that baseline of being there on at the station. And again, also, the distance from the station to the call is the other variable that we don't have any control over in the immediate sense. That is what the master plan will try to address in the future by where our future locations of our stations would be. So again, the First Watch is will help us give a situational awareness on the immediate need.
So, but I don't think I can't see how it can help our threshold. I mean, if you have to send a page out to one of your senior staff, I mean, a page takes, well, you got 2 minutes there before you can respond back to getting the senior staff now to respond and get someone else to move forward. How many seconds are we involved here to improve it? I mean, I can understand if you're trying to track it and you understand the problem of it. Is there reports coming out, the reviews of this that we can see or that GMOC can see?
Yeah, it will create monthly reports, and senior staff will really be watching the trends. The battalion chief is the day-to-day operational chief watching that, and it will not correct the call that already occurred. The purpose of that is to correct the next call. So if we have one, for example, that is non-compliant, the intent is that's going to tell us we may have a problem going on that we need to fix right now. Otherwise, the next call will be non-compliant as well, because we may have we may have our units either not in the area they need to be, or they're not able to respond quick enough. So It's the ability for the battalion chief to correct and be prepared for the next call,
got
not
it.
The one that will recur.
Right, thank you.
Any other room? Commissioner Speth.
Chief, are all of your stations on the east side of the city open and operational?
Commissioner, yes.
Okay,
all
because I understand. I thought because of budget cutbacks and restraints and everything, I thought we had closed one of the stations on the far east side, or did I? I didn't understand that correctly. Okay, well that's great. That's good news. With you guys having all of the paramedics in-house, do you expect that that's going to affect response times at all? Better, worse, the same?
Madam Mayor and Council, Commissioner Nowot, it won't affect our response time either way. We are not adding any more firefighters or taking away any firefighters or our engine companies in response. So the response times will be the same. We're going to the same calls. It's just the level of service that they're providing while they get on the call will be different.
Yeah, because I got to tell you, as a citizen, I mean, that makes me feel really good because you guys are always way ahead of the paramedics, you know, the contracted EMTs and paramedics. So I think it's awesome that we're moving to that. I want to touch a little bit on one of Commissioner Vincent's questions, and that was the GMOC. And this is a question to you guys, because I remember when I was on GMOC, we had requested, and I was wondering if you guys are still getting this. I think it's like every 6 months we were requesting a report regarding response times from both PD and fire department. Is that something you guys are getting? Is that something that is occurring?
We do not. Other than the questionnaires, we don't see response times from either of those departments.
Is that something, Ed, that changed from when I was on GMOC?
Madam Mayor, Council, Commissioner, there was a request to do that. I think as time went on, you know, one of the issues, if we produced the report on a six-month basis, the GMOC is in session for only a portion of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so the issue was we get the report, but the GMOC is not in session. What do we do with it? And I think we discovered internally that the value of doing the report, as the chief said, was it's providing real-time data, and it turns out they're actually looking at reports on call response more frequently than every 6 months in-house. So I think we ended up, you know, getting to the same effect of the fire department looking at the data on a more frequent basis, and now they're talking about seeing it real time with this new tool. So I think we've gotten the benefit of that.
Yeah, because, I mean, I know everything goes really quick when you're looking at all these thresholds, and there's so many of them to look at, and, you know, you guys are trying to put together your end-of-year summary. So was just curious if in fact, that was something that was still occurring, so... Thank you, Chief.
No other comments.
Thank you, Council. Ms. Salas.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor and Commissioners. One of the remarkable things about this report is seeing how many calls for service at the level that it's increased. The report said that there were like almost 1,500 additional or more calls for service than there were last year, even though we have the same number of staffing and the same limitations that we did last year. So kudos to your fire department captain. They're doing a yeoman's job, and they proved it by being able to get to those calls in a way that you wouldn't think so, given the number of the increase in the number of calls. I think what this really speaks to is that now that we've implemented the ALS, and I think that's wonderful, is that given the fact that our firefighters consistently show up before the paramedics do, to really focus and make it a priority to get our own firefighters trained as soon as possible. I'm concerned about the phase-in of the ALS, the paramedics, and I think that we need to, since we're not going to grow the fire department and we seem to be getting more calls for service with an aging population, that we have to make sure that our paramedics are trained. And for as much as we can to make sure that they're trained in-house. We have excellent firefighters here, and I think that they're just waiting to get trained, and we need to get that job done as soon as possible.
Thank you. Any other council comments? Mr. Ramirez?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Chief, I think you've done a great job since you've come on board in a lot of aspects. You know, I mean, we're talking about the ALS program, but in a lot of ways we've been making this department better and better, so I want to congratulate you for that first of all. And I really liked the solution. It just seemed like a really simple one, and I don't know, was it very expensive, First Watch?
The initial purchase was $20,000.
Yeah, for 20 grand, we were able to just, you know, change things and manage things a little better and improve a situation. It's really important for such an important service, you know, life-saving service, so. So thanks for that. Thanks for bringing that. And just want to echo what Councilmember Salas just said with regard to training, because it sounded like there's a way to expedite that phasing so that we have more people, more engine companies with trained individuals out on the streets sooner. And from your response to that question in one of our council meetings, it sounded like there was a possibility, right, that you could find the money maybe by borrowing or finding some way to get more people trained sooner so that we could have full service at more stations, right? And so have you thought about that some more? Can you tell us whether or not you've got an answer, a solution to that?
Yeah, Madam Mayor, Council, that was one of the requests that you had when this was approved at the council meeting, and since I've also heard from a couple other council members about that desire.
So two more? So we've got three now?
And a potential workshop on that.
Oh, okay.
So I have been looking into that. In fact, we had a meeting today in that regard about the potential options for that. What I can tell you is that, and members of the finance department are here, it's difficult to borrow ahead necessarily with that.
And that's the issue, right? It's finding the money to train them now.
Yeah.
Because we expect to get the money eventually, right, through transports.
Correct.
Right.
So in our current plan, or what was developed in the current phase-in plan, was that we had money set aside in the second year. So it's about $200,000 to send four people to school, four to five people to school for the year. It's basically sending them away for a year. And what we did was, in our phase-in program, we're starting with five of our nine stations this July. And then next year, we were going to be sending the group to school so that in the third year, they would be ready then to phase in the next phase of a couple more engine companies. And then we continued that phasing. The reason why we did that is also the goal of ours has been to keep the transport rate relatively stable so that we don't have any necessary spikes in our transport rate, which would keep us within the market of the jurisdictions here in the county. So that is why a lot of the funds to begin with had to be our startup costs. And then those were taken our first year, and then next year we would focus on some money for the training. One of the few ways that is a potential option for doing that is to accelerate the extension of an agreement with AMR. And currently what that means is that our agreement with AMR is due to expire September of next year. So when you discuss the issue of borrowing against the future, mm-hmm. we really only are allowed to borrow within the confines of the agreement we have with AMR, our current agreement, which only goes, you know, another year and a few months. So the only way we can borrow against that agreement is to extend that agreement earlier. That allows AMR to amortize the amount that they would be giving us for that that service we're providing over the period of their new contract. So that is what I'm investigating and looking at the potential option for that. Obviously, there isn't any money in the startup cost because we're using that in the startup of our five first units to take away from that necessarily sending folks to school. But it is one of our goals. I know my union is the same goal to expedite and get this service citywide as fast as we can, obviously within the confines of our transport rates and the agreements that we have. But that's one of the options that we're looking at, and I'm hoping to be able to bring something forward to you on a recommendation.
I'm confident you're going to be able to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Ms. Aguilar.
My question is not on fire. It's a general quick comment.
How about if we get through anybody else's, and then we'll take the general comments. Okay. I don't see any other members of the council. Before I turn this over to Planning Commission for consideration, to see if there are any comments by your members of a general nature.
Any concerns?
No. Thank you.
We don't have any concerns.
All right. So we'll go to the City Council. General comments, Ms. Aguilar.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. You know, I have always thought that the two most important meetings that the council has each year is the meeting where we adopt the budget and this meeting. I think we're so fortunate here in Chula Vista to have a growth management ordinance, and I think it says a lot about the foresight of the people who were on the council back in the 80s when the growth management ordinance was adopted. I think that your husband was mayor.
The good cop.
the other cop was mayor at the time. On the east side of Chula Vista, we have some of the most beautiful neighborhoods in Southern California. And the quality of life for people out there, sure, there are complaints about schools and traffic and whatever. But on the whole, those are really beautiful neighborhoods. And I am convinced that those neighborhoods that exist out there and the amenities that they enjoy are largely because of the growth management ordinance and the fact that you all, the commission, does such a good job, and such a thorough job, and put so much effort into this annual evaluation of, so how are we doing, you know? Because there are lots of ordinances on the books that look great on the books, but, you know, they just sort of collect dust. With the growth management ordinance, because of you all, we actually have an ongoing check as to how it's going, and then that gives a chance for the council and staff to fix any problems that come up. So I wanted to let you know how important I think this whole process is. And thank you so much for your contributions to our city. They're really important. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Aguilar. I'd like to echo the component about how those who are members of the public who agree that growth and its management has been handled well. We know that when the council was interviewing Mr. Masoglu, one of the questions was, what was your interpretation as far as an average ordinary citizen of how do you think growth has been handled in the city of Chula Vista? And unanimously, they said it's been thoughtful and it's worked. So thank you for bringing that up. Ms. Calvo, would you like to walk your planning commission through the resolution and the city clerk? Okay. We're in general comments.
I'll give my general comments when we're finished. I too want to just thank all of you for your service. And I would agree 100% that I think this is one of the more important meetings and one that I really enjoy having with you all every year. I guess I just want to say that you've got a lot of important work ahead of you. Because of all that's been happening and where we are, I think, we are in a transition where some of the standards that you guys have been measuring, I think a second look. And, for example, you heard the manager speak about proactive time now in the PD. maybe that's something that we need to be measuring, you know. And I think that there was some talk about a top-to-bottom review that you guys are going to be working on, so that's all something that that I think you're going to be involved in. But I would just encourage you to think creatively about what's really important, because as you know, and as you said earlier, somebody talked about the M word, right? It is the big hammer that that you all have, and we don't really want to be... I mean, that's, you know, that's like World War III, okay? That's nuclear Armageddon, you know? That's think about that. So we really need to think, I think, realistically about what we can do and what we measure and how we do that. So that's one comment. And then the other one is something I think I've said before to the Planning Commission that I think is very important. And I'm not sure how much of this you do, frankly, because I don't track your work that closely. But with regards to... I mean, real planning, where you're thinking ahead and you're looking forward. I mean, recently we just approved the, what was it, Lake Point project. And before that was the Olympic Point project, right? Some parcels on the east side of Chula Vista. And you know, that was a situation where, I felt that, I mean, certainly the developer had come and done everything they had to do and went through all the hoops that city staff put them through and, you know, to produce their project. But those two parcels in particular, I mean, I don't know how many of you are familiar with them, but they're very unique and very special parcels in Chula Vista that I felt if we as a planning commission, way before the developer showed up to develop those particular parcels, had set out maybe a new vision, because we got to the point where we said, and this was many years ago, well, what we had thought was appropriate for the Olympic Point parcel, you know, may not work. Some hotel, and I mean, there were some constraints, right, to that kind of a development. But certainly there could have been something, I think, something else. And I think we missed an opportunity to really capture something really special on the east side with those two parcels. You know, they're gone.
I'll be happy to talk to you,
Well, we could talk all day long, but I mean, my point is, looking forward on those projects, I mean, from my point of view, we got some condos, right? We got some apartments, and they're going to be very nice condos and very nice apartments. But for those particular parcels, I think that we could have done a lot better. I think that we didn't get. Go ahead, if you want
to.
Yeah.
No, I do want to speak to that. You know, that is not our scope. You know, we would be happy to do it, but it's not our scope. And this was something that was planned in the GDP for years and years.
Right.
So as far as planning, I think that would have been, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So, but we, like I said, that is not our scope of the Planning Commission.
Right. You know, I think...
Mr. Ramirez, I'm just going to ask you to tailor your comments to the item that we now have open.
Sure. Well, let me just say, I mean, I'm not... My comments are general, and they're not really meant on these particular projects. Really, this is just an example,
mm-hmm.
I think, for me, where we had an opportunity to sort of think of have a different vision for very unique parcels. I mean, what are the very unique parcels that we still have, you know, that where we could still develop a very unique vision? And frankly, I think that's where, instead of the Planning Commission just being sort of someone that waits for projects to show up, a Planning Commission who thinks ahead for those opportunities and sets the standard early on. So we don't have a situation where, you know, a developer comes and then, you know, there's confusion about what could go there and what's really the best potential.
That might be a great idea for a new commission, maybe for forward planning.
Yeah.
You know, because I think once it comes to us, it's too late. You know,
right.
That's not in our scope.
Yeah, that's the point. It's too late. Yeah.
So.
I'd like to add to that as well, because I think you've got a couple of us riled up a little bit here. And as a council member, you have the same rights to go to city staff and make your recommendations and look over these projects as well. And of course, you have a much more authority to do that above that of a planning commissioner. So there are some areas or some issues that we see that we don't like. Sometimes they come forward, but we're taking the good with the bad and reviewing them. And,
right,
and some of them are approving and some of them not. So it appears that you're thinking that the planning commission is making any decisions and it is coming forward to us. So let's just make sure that we have an understanding of that.
No, I get that. No, but I see that as a problem, though. I mean, I see that it's not your fault. I mean, I think it's But it's something I think that would be. I mean, would you like to do that? Is this something that
Mr. Ramirez, you're heading out the posted agenda.
Yeah. Is that something that you would be interested
Mr. Ramirez, you're heading out of the posted agenda. All right. Ms. Calvo.
Yes. With regarding the resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Chula Vista accepting the 2013 Growth Management Oversight Commission annual report and recommending acceptance by the City Council, is there a motion?
Second.
That's moved by Member Anaya and seconded by Member Vincent.
Member Vincent. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
At five?
Five.
And one absent.
Mm-hmm.
Council's opportunity now to look at the resolution, which will be read by the clerk. Is there a motion regarding this resolution?
Mm-hmm.
Moved by Member Bensoussan. Is there a second? Second by Member Aguilar. Madam Clerk?
This is a resolution of the City Council accepting the 2013 Growth Management Oversight Commission annual report and directing the City Manager to undertake actions necessary to implement report recommendations as presented in the staff response and proposed implementing action summary.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None. Unanimously approved. Thank you very much to staff, to Ms. Vanderbee and Mr. Batchelder in particular, and to our staff that's in the audience. I've got an announcement, though, so just hang on tight for just a minute because this is something for everybody. This next Saturday, the Creek to Bay cleanup will include Bayfront Park, Otay Lakes, and Delray Canyon. It will also include Go Green and Clean Family Day. I know Brendan thought I'd forgotten all about him. YMCA is having its Healthy Kids Day from 10 till 2. And then, as Betty Wozniss mentioned, that evening after you've worked real hard for the day, then go back by the Otay Ranch Town Center from 6 till, is it 6 to 8, Betty? 5 to, well, it's 2 more hours than I thought. And we have an announcement from one of our GMOC members.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you for bringing the flyers. Please grab a cookie on your way out and grab a flyer for the Chula Vista Community Day at Petco Park on June 23rd. Money raised is going to go to the Chula Vista Charitable Foundation, and I want to thank Councilmember Salas, Mayor Cox, and Councilmember Ramirez for being founding members. In addition, the first 500 tickets sold will get a free T-shirt, but also, hot off the presses, you'll get a chance to win a private meet and greet with another founding member, former Padre and current Dodger, Adrian Gonzalez. So please come out and support the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Leeweg.
Yeah, just want to make an announcement about the Community Fund Run, which is part of the fundraisers for Parks and Rec, and that's on May
11th.
May 11th. 6:30 at Olympic Training Center, so.
You can register at www.chulavistaca.gov/go-to/fun-run. You have that? And I didn't even have it written down. Woo, let's be impressed. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Thank you for your hard work.